So I'm going to talk about a very different topic from Amy. I'm going to talk about how we can use population representative samples to measure the effectiveness of disaster relief in post-natural disaster settings. And I think I'm the only person talking about natural disasters versus conflicts today, so maybe in the Q&A we can talk about how those settings are alike and different. This is joint work with Rizwana Siddiqui from the Pakistan Institute of Development Economics and Howard White at 3IE, and I'll talk about 3IE a little bit more. Nothing to disclose. So why are we interested in this topic at all? This specific piece is part of a larger project that we're doing with 3IE. The project has a couple goals. We're trying to catalog existing approaches to and challenges of impact evaluation for post-disaster aid, and also going forward try to develop a framework for just some more rigorous and comprehensive ways to do this kind of evaluation. 3IE is a relatively new initiative. It was launched by the Center for Global Development. I've put its mission there, but basically it's an evaluation clearinghouse to sort of promote, again, more rigorous evaluation of a broad range of topics, and we're starting with disaster aid. So what do we know about disasters? We know that it looks like there's increasing frequency and severity of natural disasters around the globe, and because population density tends to be quite high in vulnerable regions, the impact of those disasters is also sort of snowballing. Disasters are unexpected events. For the most part, we don't get a lot of warning about them, but we also know that exposure to them is certainly not random. We can look no further than the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans to know that, but examples from all around the world apply. And in most cases, considerable resources are devoted to aid in post-disaster settings. It may not feel like it's enough, but it's still, you know, hundreds of millions, billions of dollars that go. And we don't really know, in most cases, if that aid is doing any good. And we really don't know if we learn anything from one disaster to the next. So that creates a lot of evaluation challenges if you're interested in whether post-disaster aid does any good. If you think of sort of classic treatment versus control for evaluation, we don't know the treatment area in a disaster until after the disaster has occurred. We don't always really know what the appropriate control group is. Is it an unaffected population versus an affected population? Is it an affected population that received aid versus one that didn't receive aid? And similarly, there are multiple time periods we can look at. Are we interested in pre-disaster versus post, or immediately post? Post-disaster versus a year down the road. And of course, there's a lot of selection bias. If we just come into a post-disaster situation, we don't know who's been selectively displaced out of a region that may affect our evaluation results. And I would argue we're not always so clear about what the goal of the evaluation is. And I think it raises a lot of important internal versus external validity issues that aren't always addressed very explicitly. So I just want to talk very briefly about four case studies: Bangladesh, Hurricane Katrina, the Indian Ocean tsunami, and then the Pakistan earthquake, which the Pakistan piece is really our focus case study for the 3IE study. So that's more questions than answers at this point. But the other three are just some examples to illuminate some of these evaluation challenges. So let me start with Bangladesh. Truth in Advertising, this is actually a photo from the 2008 flooding, but I couldn't find as good one from the 1998 flooding. But flooding happens in Bangladesh every year. It's a very important part of the agricultural cycle. But we're getting these century floods, which we're supposed to get once a century, about every 3 to 5 years now. And again, the population density in flood-prone areas is very, very high, and it just wreaks havoc, and it's starting to wreak havoc very, very frequently. In 98, that was one of the extensive flood years, IFPRI, the International Food Policy Research Institute, fielded a three-round survey focusing on sort of coping strategies. What did households do? What did they do with aid in the post-disaster setting? It interviewed about almost 800 households in seven different thanas. A thana is a sub-district in Bangladesh. And all three rounds were post-flood. So they went in November, a couple of months after the peak flooding, and then two more rounds, and collected a wide range of individual and household and community measures. So I just want to show you very briefly how the sampling strategy worked. This is a data set I worked with for my dissertation research, and I was getting a lot of odd results, and spent some time looking at the way thanas had been selected for the sample versus the households that ended up in that sample. And the goal was to choose thanas that were affected and not so affected by the flooding, and also to choose thanas that were poor and less poor. And the goal was to come up with, you know, sets of poverty and flood exposure so that there'd be a range of thanas. So that was the criterion for selection. When I went back and looked at the households that ended up in those samples, I've marked in red households with a high Tanas that had a high mean household flood exposure index, and then the proportion of households in that Tana that were flood affected. And you see there's a lot of mismatch. So the Tanas were selected by objective criteria with, you know, satellite imagery and river flood levels, but the households that ended up in the sample didn't quite match. So you have to kind of wonder who's missing. And exactly the same thing happened on the poverty criterion. If you look at the mean, the log of per capita expenditures, just a household consumption measure, and the proportion of households landless, which is another good poverty measure, it doesn't really match up with the Tanas that were selected as poor Tanas based on pre-disaster poverty rates. Now, I've got a paper in sort of the publication process, and Carlo Del Nino, who actually fielded the survey, has actually published several studies with these data, and it's really hard to address this displacement issue, sort of selective displacement. And I would argue that a lot of post-disaster evaluation work doesn't look explicitly enough at who's not in the sample and what inferences we can really draw when that's the situation. Let me talk briefly about Katrina. A group actually at Princeton, Chris Paxson and colleagues, were interested in the mental and physical health effects of the disaster, and also how pre-disaster resources might protect against any adverse health effects of Katrina and Katrina-related displacement. When they looked at the literature that used studies with no baseline data, all post-disaster data, there were, you know, not surprisingly, elevated rates of stress disorders, depression, anxiety, and chronic conditions. But it's hard to know whether the disaster is causing these ill health effects or are those who are already in poor health, that should say, more vulnerable to disaster. Classic sort of confounding problem. So, you know, we don't know whether the disaster exposure is just correlated with both low SES and poor health. What Paxson and her colleagues were able to do was to take advantage of an existing data set. It was a sample of low-income adults who were enrolled in a community college pilot study. They had been interviewed in 2004-2005 and for this pilot program for community college attendance. And in the middle of the first follow-up for that sample, Katrina hit. And in the post-Katrina setting, they were able to track about 82% of that adult sample and collect a lot of good measures on exposure to Katrina and subsequent health outcomes. They had some interesting conclusions because they were able to control for baseline SES and pre-Katrina health. It turned out that those measures did attenuate the effects of loss and trauma on mental health outcomes, but not by that much. In other words, their results would not have had a lot of bias in their results if they'd been able to only use post-Katrina data. So that's interesting. They also found very little evidence that pre-disaster resources were able to protect against losses, which I will say is in contrast to what I've been able to find in the Bangladesh flood setting. But there's certainly some limitations. That how generalizable is that sample? That was a self-selected sample of low-income adults who enrolled in a community college pilot program. The loss to follow-up, they lost about 20% of the sample, but at least in this case, they could compare the characteristics of the people they lost because they had pre-Katrina data to the folks that they were able to follow up. So that's good. And I think the lessons for future disaster studies are that we really can leverage these existing samples if we go into a disaster setting. Were there any kind of pilot programs or evaluation work in process that we can use for our sample going forward? Okay, briefly on the tsunami, I would argue that natural disasters are another way to teach Americans about geography. I don't know how many of us knew where Banda Aceh was before December 2004. So in December 2004, the Indian Ocean tsunami struck. I wrote that it struck Banda Aceh here. It obviously struck many places around the Indian Ocean. And just a couple months later, a team at UCLA and the World Bank was able to propose and fund and field a really extraordinary study called the STAR study, and that stands for the Sumatra Tsunami Aftermath and Recovery Study. This was Elizabeth Frankenberg, Duncan Thomas, Jed Friedman, Tom Gillespie, really an extraordinary study. They were able to do it for two reasons. They were able to do it because they already had an existing relationship with a fantastic data collection and survey research group in Indonesia with whom they'd done a lot of work before. They could rely on. They knew they could get the study out very quickly. They were also able to use Indonesia's Susana study. They do an annual large-scale population representative socioeconomic survey in Indonesia called Susanas. And Elizabeth Frankenberg and her colleagues were able to convince the Indonesian government to release that sample as the baseline sample. So the Susanas was done in August, September of 2004. The tsunami hit in December, and that became a population representative baseline sample, which was fantastic. And it means that the tracking that the STAR study has been able to do in terms of mortality rates, health effects, displacement, are really top-notch. They're very, very rigorous, much better estimates of this kind of thing than any of the other studies that have just gone in post-disaster and started counting heads and seeing who's there. And they're planning about 5 follow-up rounds. They've done 2, and it's funded through, I think, 2011. I think there are a lot of lessons here, particularly with the STAR study, the value of having a large-scale socioeconomic survey in place to use as a baseline sample, the value of these existing research partnerships to very quickly get a study out, the ability in this case, I mean, I think this was Elizabeth Frankenberg's just ability to just jump within, I think, 2 weeks of the tsunami. She had this proposal to NIH and the NSF and the World Bank. And also really creative use of multiple data sources. So they've measured exposure to the tsunami using satellite imagery. They're able to sort of look at land use and land cover and see how that changed to sort of target which areas were most affected. In terms of the Pakistan earthquake, this is, again, more questions than answers at this point. The earthquake is going to be the focus of our 3IE case study. At this point, we're sort of collecting the reality, what pre-disaster data sets might be available, the way Susanas and the Katrina sample were available, and other ways of drawing a population representative sample using administrative units like villages or schools. And then going forward, we want to sort of use that as a case study to think about what regular or ongoing data collection efforts should be in place in vulnerable settings so that we, you know, when disaster strikes, we have a sample ready to go to use. And based on that, what would an ideal assessment strategy be? I look forward to your Q&A. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Allison. We're going back to Iraq with our next presenter. Raki Sinha will talk about refugee health needs of Iraqi nationals in Amman, Jordan. She is currently a fourth-year medical student at Western University. She completed her MPH Johns Hopkins, and during that year, she had the opportunity to work on the implementation of the survey that she'll be talking about right now. So please welcome Rakhi.